You're watching with us, TV Book Post.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us here at Red Ice. Great to see you all out there. Hope you're all doing well. We got an exciting interview for you guys lined up here today. And Lana's joining me over there as well.
I am, yes. Happy May Day, by the way.
It is May Day.
Holiday in Europe, which we're also celebrating.
That's right. We have Thomas Russo here from Patriot Front live in studio with us. Thank you for coming in, Thomas. Good to see you.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Of course.
Looking forward to the discussion.
Yes, we as well. So how do you like North Idaho this time, I should say, compared to last time you were here?
Yes, the circumstances on my second visit to the area could not be more different than on the first. No, I mean, I love the region. You know, as always, I love America in general. I love every inch of the continent that I go to. I love the areas that are beautiful and love the areas that are great to experience. And I also love the areas that are great for a good political fight, not a literal fight, but of course a political fight. But I think it has been good to be welcomed into North Idaho, which is in for once, hopefully many times in the future.
Yes.
But, no, it's certainly a good sign to see how things have grown. And, of course, you know, I wasn't steering clear of the area. I just hadn't had a good opportunity to show up, and I appreciate y'all for giving me a great excuse to come up here.
Yeah,
again.
No, thank you for coming.
No, I love the area. I love the history. I love the culture. You know, I love the people. And, you know, I think it's a sign that I think nationalist organizing is growing and is moving forward in the right direction, that that all these areas continually will become more hospitable, even those, you know, which we have been slighted from and attacked from. Mm-hmm. You know, like y'all have borne your fair share of slings and arrows over the years, as we have. And I think it's a good sign that persistence and perseverance, you know, eventually conquers all things.
Yes.
That's right.
Indeed. Yeah, we had a good Valpurgis night.
That's
yesterday.
Right.
That's why,
or Beltane.
That's why I have a burn mark here. I got too close to the embers. That's why. So I'm wondering. That's what you get comments on, right?
That's where we hung out. So that's where we first met. And my first impression of you and your guys was like, these are just pleasant, likable, you know, southern gentlemen. I just immediately was like, bam, I connected with you guys, liked you guys. And I think first impression matters, you know? You pick up on things. It's there.
Yes. No, and that's a big thing that the organization takes a lot of care and caution with, is how the men carry themselves. And, of course, you know, when we're doing the marches, and that's where we get most of the first impressions, because those are seen by millions and millions of people. But when it comes down to that, what people see is, you know, what we believe, and what we believe in is a structured, strong, orderly, American, thoroughly American society. When people see the marches, that's what they see. And sure, it looks outlandish, it looks strange and abnormal, but at the same time, what we're living in is the abnormality in history.
That's correct.
The current society is the great defacement upon the history of the European race. So what you're actually seeing when you see the marching ranks of, you know, our activists, what you're seeing is the you know, is a sort of return to form. It's a restitution, a reconstitution, if you will, of the American spirit in a very masculine approach.
And these sort of marches aren't unusual in Europe.
No, not at all.
It's Americans see it and they're oh my God, feds, who are these feds? This kind of stuff has been happening in Europe forever with torches and uniforms, and like it's nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing new, right?
Well, I did want to ask you about the origins, obviously. When you started it, was it you who started it? What were some of your motivations at that point?
And actually on the website, if you have it up there, if you go to the homepage, we have a great video which shows, you know, that plays automatically, which shows years of our organizing, which is great to illustrate the point. So, you know, when we started, you know, PF got its start in 2017. I was at Charlottesville, of course, you know, which is which
I was there too.
Yes,
yeah. And we didn't meet, but I was.
We did. Yeah. We were in the same zip code, yeah. And we both did not have the greatest experience, to
nope.
say the least.
Nope.
So and it was a chaotic day. And I think a lot of people were there with good intentions. A lot of people were there who genuinely wanted to protest and seek a redress of grievances that they had against society and their government and in any manner of corruption in society. But what was lacking was the organization. What was lacking was there was a supreme issue with the logistics, the tactics, the strategy, the messaging, and the coordinating of all these groups. Again, lots of good people. There were some people who probably, I wouldn't consider shining examples of the European race or the American nation who were present, but, that's not the point. The rally ended up being a disaster, which I think is not controversial to say. And I was there. I was not a planner of the rally. I was not, involved in any of the fights or anything, but I saw everything. I experienced it firsthand. And after leaving it, the group I was in at the time started fighting amongst itself. And I think Charlottesville, the reason the SPLC or the ADL will have this thing that I left that group because of the bad coverage of Charlottesville, which is silly because they just keep using Charlottesville when they describe me even to
right.
this day. So
yeah.
If that was my plan, it's ridiculous and completely impractical. The reason that I left that organization was because of these irreconcilable personal grievances which people had and past a certain point of this infighting, this movement drama that is so frequent, and you still see it today, but you don't see it with Patriot Front. I decided that, everybody who wants to work with me, everybody who has experience with me, everybody who trusts me as an organizer, we're going over here and we're going to do something new. We're going to do our thing. And everybody else, it's been nice knowing you,
Yeah.
May the best man win. And then I started Patriot Front with about 24, maybe 30 guys mm-hmm. spread out over the South and the West. We had maybe about a dozen to 20 guys in Texas, and we had a few people scattered in Florida and all the way up to Washington. So it was very fledgling beginnings. I'm the founder of the organization. I've always been the leader of the organization. I've always been the chief organizer. But, the proportion of work and throughout the years, I have done every single job in the organization. When we were getting certain projects refurbished or off the ground, I've been heavily involved in every aspect at any given point in time. I've made, a lot of the materials personally. I've done and managed vetting personally. I've gone around and planned every aspect of the demonstrations, started out with me being the one to take the point with it. And gradually we've been able to attain a greater level of sophistication with our demonstrations in particular, so that now there are people who manage our transportation. There are people who manage our camp and lodging logistics. There are people who manage our travel parties when we have convoys of 30, 50 vehicles.
Can't do it all. Takes a village.
We have people who manage the security checkpoints, and yeah. we have people who manage all these other things. And these people have been doing these specific jobs for years in some cases within the organization. But I was there at the nucleus of those before we were able to split off and delegate mm-hmm. these things. And then, the story of the organization developing, at least from a leadership perspective, is largely one of delegation. But anyways, to answer the question, yes, I've always been very much involved in the organization. It grew out of a great sort of a response to what I see as it was a failure to properly plan and coordinate among
yeah.
the political movement. And a lot of people, it was easy for them to get disheartened, disenchanted, right? Crestfallen, when seeing the aftermath. And a lot of people, said to me and each other that, okay, nationalism, the demonstrations, you just can't do that in America mm-hmm. anymore, right? It's over. They've taken that right away from us. And, my response was, hold on. Let's give it a shot. Let's see if we can do it right. And I think we've largely proven that there is a lot of these tactics which you can do if you do them right. And I wish we had more rights. I wish we had more liberties. I wish we had more room to operate in. But the fact of the matter is, in the broader perspective, you need to be using your rights up to the limit. because anything you leave them, they'll take.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Anything, it's,
that's right.
Yeah. Your political rights, your rights to free speech are use it or lose it. So that's why PF goes right up to the level of, you know, civil disobedience, because anything less is sacrificing ground.
Have your parents seen you on the news yet?
Many times. Yeah. Many times.
Of course they have.
My parents, they're not involved in what I do, and you know, they don't necessarily, you know, they're completely, you know, sectioned off, and they have received, you know, messages and stuff over the years, but they've never been involved in anything. But yes, absolutely. And you know, when you have the doxings and, you know, the media doing these crazy hit pieces, you know, they want folks to go after people's families.
Yeah, because
a lot of times they know that the person they're doxing, you know, they can tell, you know, when it's the left, it's the media or the Antifa, they can tell that that individual is a true believer. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to go after them in particular, right? You're going to go after their family. You're going to go after people who are – you're seen as more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And all that that does, whether I'm seeing it happen to somebody else or it's happened to me, all that that does is prove to me that, you know, we're the good guys in this story, and these people are truly motivated by a sense of malice and diabolical hatred that that is it needs to be scourged from the earth.
Indeed. I wonder, was there any inspiration in the early days? There was some European groups, right? I'm remembering that right.
I believe
early days, right?
Yes, I remember at the time, you know, especially there were a lot of European groups and you know, activists in America were heavily motivated, and there was inspiration to look at the organizations in Europe. You know, and I think a lot of them have come and gone. You know, there's still some of the same ones in certain countries. And you know,
and some of them have been banned too, by the way. Like National Action, right? In
National
England,
Action
example.
Was banned in the UK. Yep. Golden Dawn was banned in Greece. Yep. Casa Pound is still around. It's been around for many years. There's others.
Nordic Resistance Movement is like this
Nordic
close.
Nordic Resistance
you know,
Movement
from,
has had a lot of legal trouble.
Yeah. Well, America has deemed them to be a terrorist group,
right?
Yeah,
State Department put it on
I think Derdrita Weg has been around the whole time in Germany, I believe.
Yep.
And, of course, France has the same large movement, but the organizations come and go and come and go because of their legal structure. They keep dissolving them, but, you know, they reconstitute and –
But you're not an organization on paper.
So, yes, right? Patriot Front does not exist as a legal entity. Patriot Front is a movement. Patriot Front is an idea, and that is something which Patriot Front has no property. Patriot Front has no legal entities because that's not what it is. That's not what it's meant to be. It's not a political party. You know, we're not registered with the FEC. That is not the purpose of the organization. And you know, even if we want to engage in, and I mean we do, if we want to engage with property, if we want to have a gym space, or we want to have, you know, if we want to have guys work within some sort of electoral strategy, you don't need to be a party to do that.
Yeah.
You just need to have the opportunity, and members of the organization, of course, own property, right? But they are not the organization, legally speaking. But you know, if you looked years past, you know, there was a degree of tactical and strategic inspiration from European groups, and I think the biggest. You know, I think a lot of Americans at the time were envious of Europeans with their large demonstrations, and they seemed very strong.
Generation identity.
They were very big at the time, and they're still around. They're still around. And they had some very. I remember early on, they had some very popular anti-migration things when they went to the Alps, and they had the ship in the Mediterranean.
Yep, that's right.
So I think there was a large aspiration, and I think, you know, it's been very fascinating looking back now because, you know, in our early trip, you know, PF sent a bunch of representatives to Europe in 2019, I believe, and we went to a lot of these countries and, you know, we were looking up to these groups and we were the fledgling, you know, new kid on the block, so to speak. And then we went back in 2023 or I think 2024 you know, the tables had kind of turned a little bit where we have newer European nationalists and groups that are looking up to Patriot Front in a sense. And a lot of them said, wow, you know, I wish we could do what you do. But of course, you know, they have all these legal barriers and things of that nature. But it is very heartening to be an inspiration. And of course, I don't mean to say that, you know, that we're better than them or that, you know, we have very different environments. But I'm very happy that we can provide something which Europeans have provided to us in the context, which is kind of an impetus to grow and adapt new ideas. because I think nationalism is a war of ideas, and it is a war of finding ingenious ways to push your message and survive all of these attacks that are made against us.
Yeah, no, indeed. Yeah, you need different type of strategies, and as I said, the legal framework will define what those are, but at the same time, yeah, one group might come up with something, a template that works much better, or like that, you know, and then you take inspiration from each other.
Absolutely.
You learn from each other. No, so that's good to know.
Yeah, real brief. I just kind of want to know, what was your political evolution, how you got to where you are now?
Right.
Because I read stuff online. Oh, he was in high school. He was political. He had this newspaper, all that, you know.
Yeah. So I was, I did start thinking about politics when I was in high school. Middle schoolers, I think, rarely are political. I've never met one.
Never.
I was about 16 years old, and that was around 2016. It was earlier than that. But it was the Trump phenomenon was just coming into play, and I had already started getting into, you know, consuming political content on the internet, and I was made aware largely of the migrant invasion of Europe, mm-hmm. which is a huge hot button issue, and I'd largely been aware of conservative politics, just because, you know, Fox News plays in the living room, you know, you hear things on the radio, you know, mm-hmm. you grew up in Texas and you are very familiar with the Republican baseline, arguments, and I was never really a dyed-in-the-wool conservative when it came to the Republican Party. Of course, I had beliefs early on that you could attribute to that, but I was never organized with those types of people. And of course, I was in Boy Scouts. You know, I'm an Eagle Scout, so you know, you had a good upbringing there that teaches you a lot of virtues. You learn a lot about American history. I was probably one of the last generations of Boy Scouts to get the proper thing out of the program before it was corrupted and bankrupted and everything
else. Before gays started raping little boys.
Yes, yes. Yes. But I was lucky to have a great experience, and I think my troop was a very positive experience on me, because a lot of the things that I think are very important in a nationalist today aren't just virtues that you are. It's not just having the right opinions. You need to have the right virtues. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that comes from having the right experiences. I think a lot of young men are not tested like they should be. A lot of young men, you know, have never been in a situation where you're knee deep in mud and, you know, part of your young man child brain is saying, oh, I wish I could call my mom right now and get picked up. But you can't. Right.
Yeah.
And that is an important thing that, you know, a 15-year-old needs to be put in that situation of, hey, sometimes life sucks and you have to rely on yourself and push through it with the people around you. And I learned a lot of good leadership skills. And I was on the newspaper. And I made some political cartoons, which were a little bit too edgy for my teachers at the time. But I was pushing the envelope, so to speak. And I started following the news more. And I actually think in high school, I did learn about the very traditional classical principles of journalism in that class.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hugely discordant within what I would look at, you know, especially with the coverage of Trump and everything, of the media there. That great confusion between those two principles largely led me to have a great distaste for the media, which has never
settled.
It has never settled. It has never gotten any better, trust you. But, you know, all those things in confluence, and then, I was, you know, very much swept up into, you know, the political or the online space. And then the summer I graduated, I was going to a rally in Virginia, and the rest is history. So I never really, as soon as I graduated high school, I was, you know, within 6 months, I was doing Patriot Front. Mm-hmm. So it has nationalist organizing has been my entire adult life. I've had jobs, right? I do Patriot Front full time right now, but I've had normal jobs for the first, you know, for the first 3 or 4 years. But this has always been my primary thing my entire adult life, and even a little bit before that. So I tried to start as early as I could. I wish I started at 15, but I don't think anybody would have taken me seriously.
So would you say Patriot Front is a political group or an activist group?
Right. So, you know, I believe that we have so many tactics. We have so many ways to do what we want to do. And I think we need to create an umbrella and a movement that's large enough to contain a lot of very different, but still unite, you know, different tactics, but united ideals, mm-hmm. right? United virtues. So, I think activism, I try to define it as almost a philosophy, right? More so than a specific tactic. And activism, I think, is the goal of organizing people to solve a problem, to redress a grievance. And that can happen through conventional politics where, you know, you're trying to get some city councilman elected, or you're trying to get some bill overturned, or even on the federal level, although once you go higher in levels of government, attempting that change without first stepping through many other levels becomes more and more difficult and it takes more resources. I digress. You know, the organization is an activist group, but it's also a political group. But I try to explain it as if there's sort of a triangle in this philosophy. You have people who are non-political, and those are people who have sort of given up on the idea of society. They're very cynical, or they're nihilistic. They're either doing nothing or they're doing something which is probably destructive to themselves and those around them. You know, that is not what we are. However, there is a tiny kernel of truth in that. That is, certain conventional structures are beyond saving and must be, as the Declaration of Independence says, you know, altered or abolished. And then you have people that are purely conventionally political. And largely speaking, you know, a lot of them, and you know, some of them have secret nationalist opinions, but nationalist opinions aren't very good for you if you keep them a secret, if you don't act on them. So they will find that you can moderate yourself to attain more conventional political approval, and then it becomes a negative feedback loop until you are no longer a radical, you are no longer a revolutionary.
You compromise yourself into
your congratulations. You are, you know, you have sold your soul, you know, and no matter what you gain for the price of your soul, it is worth nothing. So, you know, that's the conventional political side of things. And however, there is a kernel of truth to that as well, small as it may be, that there is something to be said in organizing, and there is something to be said in trying to change the country. So we try to unite those two things into an ascendant syncretic philosophy of extra political action. We, you know, Patriot Front is extra political. We organize with traditional political principles outside of the conventional realm of politics. And because of that, we're able to have a revolutionary footing, and we have something of an ideological redoubt where the organization is this incorruptible source of nationalist ideology. You know, we do not compromise. We cannot be bought. We cannot be bargained with. We cannot be threatened into changing our beliefs. Goodness knows they've tried. And because we have this, we can sally out into all these other political spaces, and we can engage in networking, we can engage with businesses, and even in some conventional political spaces, you know, when and where the opportunities present themselves, and they do. But we are not concerned with compromise something that could happen to us, because we have this redoubt built up. We have a fortress of our virtue, which we always return to. And I think that's a good sort of overlying philosophy.
What do you say to some of those MAGA types that are like, well, why do they have to cover up their face? They, you know, what are you hiding,
yes.
Right?
There's a lot of justifications for anonymity. You know, and a big reason is that it protects a lot of what we do. A lot of our activists, you know, marching is not the only thing they do, right?
Correct.
A lot of them have businesses, a lot of them have professions, a lot of them have families, a lot of them have plenty of things that they do or are involved in, which their identity could potentially lead to those other actions, those other productive endeavors becoming a target for our opposition. So I'm not trying to hide anything that we believe, but we are trying to hide our identities. That is the purpose of the mask. You know, but Everything we say is fully honest, but I'm going to withhold information that could only lead to an attack on some of our tactics and some of our productive endeavors, because, and especially, you know, who is going to be most interested in seeing us unmasked? Well, it'd be the people who want to do us harm.
Exactly.
And you see a lot of the conservatives, and they say, all right, we'll take off your masks and all that stuff, but we've done things without masks. We've handed out flyers many occasions where guys are unmasked. Even with the Jake Shields interview, the video where we're getting coffee with him and chatting very candidly, you know, most of the guys there are unmasked. And do the conservatives then leap to try to dox them to prove that they're feds when they finally get some faces to see? No, of course not. You know, it's a very much confirmation bias thing that you're only upset when you see the mask, but whenever you see somebody who isn't wearing masks, then, oh, it's fine. And when we did the March for Life recently in January, a lot of the guys were handing out flyers on masks, talking with hundreds, thousands of people walking through the crowds. Mm-hmm. And, of course, do the Fed accusations stop? No. Not really. Maybe it was never about the masks, and it's actually a deeper, unsettling thing about a worry about conservative sensibilities not being congruent with nationalism, or a fear of giving up what you've dedicated your whole life to, even if it is based upon a series of contradictions about how anybody can be American. Maybe there's something like that to it. But the masks also have a very productive element in being a sign of selflessness. Right, when we are all masked in the column, when we are doing something where the message is the man is a symbol more than he is an individual. You know, it speaks to something. It speaks to a principle of political virtue, which is that I'm doing this not for myself. I'm not doing this so that you look upon my name and ascribe it credit. I'm doing it for the action itself. I'm doing it for its own worth and value. And I think that also it protects us against the kind of people who would get involved in politics, get involved in our work and our organization for personal gain, to put their name everywhere.
Yep.
It immunizes us. So there's many purposes to the mask, both tactical and in principle and philosophy.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's a lot of anonymous people online, and they have YouTube channels and X accounts.
It's the same with what was it? I don't want to spend too much time on this because it's so retarded, the accusation.
Yes. I just hear it all the time.
Well, I'm just saying, this was some Biden thing or something, and then, of course, now you have a transition in the White House, and then, you're still here. You're doing, right? So these things are just...
Musk said that Doge cut our funding a few days ago, I think.
Really?
Which is funny.
Named Patriot Front?
He responded to a post that said, hey, where did these Patriot Front guys go? We didn't go anywhere, by the way. And Musk said Doge cut their funding, which is fascinating because he would know. I think he's making a joke, but who knows what he's thinking. He's a very strange man. And then a bunch of people were like, ha, I knew it. And it's like, okay, explain this. They make these arguments that, hey, we've disbanded. Hey, we're gone. Hey, nobody's ever heard of them. But all of these arguments you can only really use once. It's like, hey, they disbanded, and that's a mean to discredit us, but that only works until we show up again. And the argument of, like, nobody's ever heard of these guys. That only works until you hear of us again.
Yeah.
Furthermore, I mean, you guys are actually working on something that's helping white Americans. I have not known of any Fed that's ever actually helped white Americans in any shape, way, or form.
They're going to have to grapple, as they see us throughout the second Trump administration. They're going to have to grapple. So is your favorite Indian Kash Patel, is he now in charge of the white supremacist movement? Does that make
exactly.
sense?
Yeah, exactly. I know. Yep. That's true.
Maybe the Republicans are the real racists and they turn around and who knows? An endless spree of mental gymnastics. Maybe they should...
Maybe they should do something instead, huh?
They should do some regular gymnastics, maybe.
Whining on everyone else. Well, it was the same thing. Like, where's the overweight guys? And I thought, wait a minute. I thought there was the DEI thing. All right, the FBI has gone more towards like wokeness, and they're hiring all these fat lesbians and stuff now. And it's like, how do you this? You can't piece this together.
No, and it's,
it was fit young men, but those are out. Those are not welcomed anymore in the FBI.
Yeah, that's right.
It's very telling, and I think all of the Fed accusations, and a lot of it has been seeded, I'm almost sure, by people with duplicitous intentions. However, they can all kind of be boiled down to the premise of Patriot Front is too good to be true. There's no way you can get many men out.
Well, exactly. We couldn't do this on our own. Therefore, which shows you that the complacency and what a sad state.
No, absolutely.
That is in.
We are both good and true. We are not too good to be true.
Right.
And it speaks to a larger apathy and a sort of the demoralization of the American spirit, where people say that we could never do this. It's like you can, and the reason you can is that you're looking at it. All that you have to do, the first step of reclaiming America is believing that you can, having the hope that it can be done. But these people are stuck in a loop where they do not have that, and they're hoping for other people to come and save them.
Someone to fix it for them. That's right. Yes. Why don't we get into that?
Reclaiming America.
Yes. I mean, obviously, this is a big topic. And how do you do? How do you see
what
that?
What kind of
out?
American like, are you? What kind of America?
So when we use the phrase "Reclaim America," obviously it is our chief slogan. You could even say it's the motto of the organization. But it's a very wide-reaching thing. Reclaiming America is not just about eventually we want somebody who is the head of state to have our ideology. That would be great, but that's a very singular goal. And what we need is a comprehensive change which starts and goes through every level of American society. So one of the elements is reclaiming the identity, the name of American. And this is something, you know, we are unearthing our history. We are pushing the message that to be an American is to be a descendant of the European race, is to be someone who has this amazing heritage of conquerors and pioneers and statesmen and revolutionaries and rebels and you know, Indian fighters and everything. You know, we want to reclaim our identity, whereas so many people, and, you know, you've seen this with a lot of the Indians lately, or when I had my interview with Patrick Bet-David. You know, they say, well, anybody can be an American. Being an American is an economic practice. Being an American is a philosophy. And of course, you know, they never answer why other people in India or Mexico can't be American over there then. You know, so it's reclaiming our identity, reclaiming an ownership of our heritage, and being an aggressive cultural counterweight to everything that has been uprooted, everything that has been deracinated and diluted and destroyed. So that's one element of it. Second, you know, we want to reclaim our spaces. We want to reclaim the public space. We want to reclaim institutions, and the institutions that we cannot you know, alter, we will abolish and replace, you know, as it says in the Declaration. When such systems, when, you know, government becomes harmful to these ends, you know, that you will alter or abolish it. You know, and gradually this is a greater process of reclaiming our identity, reclaiming our culture, reclaiming our name as a nation, reclaiming the life and dignity of those within the country. And it's very deceptively simple. A lot of what we're doing is just a simple practice. When you really boil it down to the principle of it, what we're doing is we're getting together resources, including manpower. Manpower is a resource, and we are spending those resources, time is also a resource, to create change in the country. And that change can be in minds, lives, or bodies, right? Or it can be in spaces. It can be in physical infrastructure, emotion, you know, or a social infrastructure, or ideological infrastructure. But we accumulate resources in the organization, and then we spend them to create change, and that change then in turn allows us to collect more resources. And again, time is a resource. Men are a resource, right? You know, followers on social media are a resource. Money is a resource. All of these things. And we have a very, we are a very circular, spherical expanding in every direction, a series of tactics that we are trying to reach people. We are trying to find people wherever they are. We are trying to message in every platform we can. And we are also trying to improve the lives of our members in whatever way we can. Members of the organization find themselves, you know, throughout their years of membership being in better shape. They will have traveled to new places. They will have met new people. They may have become better, better patriarchs of their family. They may have even met the person that they end up creating a family with. You know, if you go around and you become the man that a woman might like to be with, you know, and these, they could, you know, they could find new jobs. They could, you know, they could engage in political work, right? Even of a conventional variety or anything else. They could be helped in their professions. They could help, you know, people who are growing a homestead or have a property. Great. We have a lot of manpower. And, you know, if we have a community built up, we can help you.
The Amish.
Yes. Yeah. Right. We're very tech savvy Amish. Yeah. But no, the community, and it's a great sign of things. And, so we need to change everything about how people live for the better, and we need to reach people however we can, wherever they are, and we need to create a message and change the philosophy. And gradually that, over a time scale of small changes, creates big changes. And, you know, it's just a matter of what every other group is doing. I think, you know, there's a certain phenomenon in the dissident movement in America where people become somewhat paralyzed about the lack of a plan. You know, you hear people, you know, sometimes asking, say, well, what's the plan? Well, how are we going to do this? How are we going to create these great changes? But the people that are despoiling our heritage and birthright are not paralyzed in any way.
No.
And they have not been, even when it looked, you know, you look at America, you know, 60, 80, 100 years ago, and turning it into what it is now could have seemed like this great perilous task. There's no way you could do it, they would say. But when you look at, you know, the Sikhs taking over the trucker industry, or you look at the, you know, you look at the Indians taking over, or the Koreans taking over the various industries, or you look at the Jews taking over the industry or the institution of Congress, for example, you know, they do not have this problem. They do not have this paralyzing despondency over lack of a plan. What they're doing is just growing and organizing through spaces and finding cracks and opportunities that they can expand within. And the principle is simple. They are just attaining whatever they can and using it to create change, but they're creating change for the worse. We want to create change for the better.
Yeah.
So the organizing practice, can America be reclaimed? Well, it has to be. and that's the option for our survival. You know, and a lot is going to change. The future will bring unexpected realities.
Oh, yes.
However, you know, America has grown in the past. If America needs to shrink, if America needs to change in some facet of its tangible reality, then sure, it will. But the practice is that the nation is not the outline on the map. The nation is the people, and the nation is our connection to this land. And, you know, we won't be driven from this land. We will not be separated from our identity, and we will not have our bonds to each other and our bonds to our virtues and our morals, you know, corrupted. That is the ultimate practice. And so long as we are resolute in those principles, and so long as those things cannot be done to us, then America is to be reclaimed, because everybody who does not hold those will no longer be American.
What are you saying to those people that are like, well, the demographics have changed, you know,
sure,
American nationalism, white nationalism, it would never be possible anymore because of the current demographics.
Nationalism, right, was the norm for a great section of human history leading up until very recently. Nationalism is the natural state of things, because nations are natural. Nations are, you know, if you restarted the world over again and you put people everywhere, you would have nations. They would be different nations, but you would have them. You know, so because nations are natural, nationalism is natural, and what we do and what we are doing is the baseline reality of human civilization. So to say that it is impossible, I think, is ridiculous. And I think those people have been victimized by the demoralization. And I've already done a lot of things in my organizing that people used to say was impossible. I've already done a lot of things that people say you can't do, or that they, you know, maybe they couldn't do them, but somebody can. And the more I progress and the more we grow, the more I realize that maybe our situation isn't as hopeless as some people may have led you to believe from behind a keyboard. Maybe there's more and more people, and we run into people every day in completely random places across the country that think like us. It's just a problem, mm-hmm, of they haven't been introduced to people that act like us. And I'm, you know, I've said it before and I believe it, that if everybody who thought like a nationalist acted like one, we'd have our country tomorrow. Right.
That's true.
The biggest thing people lack is courage. And the biggest element to pursue courage is often by seeing somebody else do it.
Yeah,
right?
It's contagious. As
exactly.
I say, right?
Yep. So when people say that, I'm utterly and unrepentantly dismissive of people that that give me that kind of rhetoric, because even in the chance that there's somehow nothing to do, I would rather live my life fighting for what I believe in, live my life fighting for the right thing. You know, you wouldn't tell the soldiers at the Alamo, you know, that, oh, it's so hopeless, because
it's
even
over.
If you're sacrificing everything,
yeah,
the fact that you sacrifice it for a greater ideal means that your life and death and everything is so much more imbued with value than somebody who lives the life of a coward. Because, you know, living the life of a coward and somebody who does not face evil, especially, there's plenty of evil to face. It's not hard. It'll come up to you, right?
Mm-hmm. It will find you.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's not a challenge. You know, facing it is a challenge, but finding it is not.
Yeah.
You know, living a life like that is it's not worth it.
I think it's just, you know, part of their approach to this is this, well, you know, the system is rigged again, which is true, right?
Sure.
I mean, obviously, white people, you know, European stock Americans have a much harder time to be allowed to organize in the same way that other ethnic groups do.
Yes.
In many cases, of course, they're getting help and aid and money and resources, and they get shooed, you know, a shoe in here and there. And so all that's true, right? But as you said, it's kind of also, that's almost a design to paralyze you then.
Yes.
To like, make, don't even try because it's already
too
lost,
hard. You can't
right?
do it.
No, and it's also important to realize that when we actually engage in organizing and we engage in political spaces and these people are our opponents, I don't mean to sound too egregious here, but we're better than them. We're better than them at what we do, and we're better than them at being Americans. And, you know, we can, you know, people that defame the organization, people that try to out-organize us, we're at least 10 times more effective per capita, you know, per dollar spent than what they do. When we went to D.C. one time, you know, there was an article, and we spent maybe a few grand on everything to do our march in Washington, and the police department spent somewhere around $3 million.
Holy shit.
So,
that's a win right there.
So that's the dynamic we're dealing with. And when we engage in political messaging, when we do one of these marches, we are achieving levels of virality and promotion that could not be paid for with thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of dollars. We're getting more views than a Super Bowl commercial when we go out there and do a big march.
Yeah. So eventually they're going to stop covering it because that has been their tactic, right? Let's just stop covering some of these outlets and some of these people
that.
Because
it's a containment strategy, right? To like I wonder if they noticed something in 2016, 17, 18, that period where there was a lot of attacks on everyone, all kinds of groups and stuff, and then
huge
all of a sudden
articles,
they're like kind of this pullback, and it seems that they're kind of more select. I don't know if that's an official policy they have, but it seems to be the case.
I don't think it's official. Yeah. In order for them to do it fully to an organization of PF size, and since we create spectacles that are really hard to ignore, I think in order for them to do it now, they would need to have a level of ideological discipline, which I would usually not ascribe to the media.
I don't think they have that. Yeah, that's true.
I think we've gained this position that we're almost too big to ignore, and I think actually. In the last few years, the change to the overall media landscape, where it's not just the mainstream media, it's not just CNN and all that other stuff. The spaces on Twitter and all these other platforms have been opened up a lot more. Yeah. Now, largely on Twitter or X, it's been opened up to a lot of conservative-controlled pundits. But they're not able to shut up about us, even when we're not in the news cycle, even when we're not doing anything. Random posts about us being feds or something other will go viral.
Yeah, see it every
midweek,
with no cause of it.
They can't help themselves, and I don't want them to. and a lot of people, the Fed jacketing does backfire too, because not only is it something which can be disproven, but it's something which a lot of people first hear about us as them calling us feds, and it's a mystery, right? So people dig into it, and what do they actually find when they dig into it is that we're not. So we've had a lot of people join us, and we ask them, we always ask them, how'd you hear about us? You know, what was the first thing you heard? And they say, well, it was the media calling you all feds, but I kept digging. And I mean, you have this huge, how many Americans are there who have questioned popular narratives pushed by a lot of people in the media, whether it's about immigration, whether it's about race being this purely cosmetic factor? You can even go into other, theories, whether the matters around the JFK files or 9/11, there's a huge segment of the American population who is deeply distrustful when they are told, methinks they do protest so much that these people are feds. Maybe there's something to it. And there's a huge demographic of people that look into that, and we see them every day.
So how's your vetting? Because I'm sure they're feds trying to get in there at some point, right?
We ultimately...
Maybe they learn something. Yes. Maybe they change. I don't know.
So the specific I hope they all change for the better.
Yes.
So the specifics of our vetting process are, of course, proprietary, and me talking about it on the air would be deleterious in its effectiveness. But, we have a comprehensive vetting process. It's always adapting. It's always evolving. We're always improving upon it. And there's several stages to it. Obviously, we want to prevent the bad people from even getting in. There's layers, because maybe a bad person slips through. So we want to make sure that the bad person can't do that much damage. So you want a prevention. You want to nullify any bad effects in the organization. We have a strong internal culture. If anybody in the organization starts talking about, hey, I want to go train with guns, then you are out. That is strange. That stands out like a sore thumb. We have strong rules against violence. We have strong rules against anything to do with drugs. All of our events are dry events. Before every demonstration, you're looking at them now, before every demonstration, before any of this happens, what you're seeing now, we have debriefings. We have, we have lawyers. We plan everything ahead to be absolutely safe, lawful, and especially after CDA, the whole argument they made was, oh, y'all had a conspiracy to riot. And I was like, well, we did conspire to be here, but not to riot.
Right.
So we make sure to have we have a conspiracy before we go out, and we make sure there's lots of evidence to it. But the trick is, the conspiracy is to commit a lot of legal activism, a lot of totally legal organizing. So if anybody comes in afterwards and tries to say, hey, actually, y'all were here to attack people, y'all were here to hurt people, well, I have videos of all the briefings, and I have everybody raising their hands and saying, I agree, when I talked about how this was going to be a peaceful public assembly for the purpose of redressing our grievances against a government, and all that no longer cares about us. So we have tons of systems throughout in terms of internal conduct and also the way that we manage these demonstrations, so that any attempt to transmute or corrupt the organization or any of its individual functions into something which is going to result in harm to our people or even to others, or random pedestrians and onlookers, is immediately upon the first step, it is outlandish. It is so alien to our systems that it is called out and expunged.
Has it ever happened? Have you been forced to expel someone from the group?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, throughout the years, we haven't had all the same members as we had back in 2017.
Right. Yeah.
You know, people have come and people have gone. Like any entity, you know, the same thing happens in companies and friend groups and bands and everything else that people are in.
Yeah. But
we are judicious. If anybody says, you know, indicates any sort of, you know, quality that might be prevalent among somebody who is a bad actor or just somebody who doesn't know better, then yeah, they will be first encouraged, you know, depending on the severity of the infraction, of course, they will be encouraged to change their ways with a very, very due haste. And if they are uninterested or incapable of doing that, then they will be, you know, they will be removed. Because ultimately we have to prioritize, you know, like we try to act a very solid principle that I always come back to with the organization is we try to act like a good government should. So we prioritize the safety of the whole over allowing the incongruous conduct of any particular individual. You know, so, you know, sure, some people might be saying things which technically you are legally allowed to say per free speech, but, you know, the organization has higher standards. Mm. So we demand a lot of discipline. But the same, you know, that may seem like an inconvenience to some people, like, oh, well, there's these rules and I'm not allowed to drink and I got to be very orderly and I can't run around in the marches wherever I want to be. But the same thing, that discipline and you're giving, you know, every man gives a little bit into the pot of collective discipline. But at the same time, what you get out of that is entire safety. Right.
Yeah.
What you get out of that is the safety of your job, the safety of your family, the safety of your legal status, the safety of your physical body, and ultimately the safety of your objectives, the safety you have as you meet and conquer these objectives. So it's a very – it's not a trade that takes much thinking in terms of how it happens. But, you know, so vetting is a process which, you know, it goes deep into the organization. You know, you have vetting throughout every stage of membership, and, you know, we are very much always concerned with the hygiene of the organization.
That's a good thing, yeah. Can anyone of European stock apply to be a member? Has there ever been a non-European stock application?
So,
what happens then?
In order to be a member, you have to be, you know, not only of European stock, but you have to be of American heritage. You know, we've had a few cases where people...
So Henry can't join.
Well,
are you saying Henry can't?
Europeans can assimilate. Europeans can assimilate into being Americans. Yeah, I would know. I have ancestors who did so. But you know, we've had Europeans who are, you know, so to speak, fresh off the boat, and you know, they still have thick accents. Maybe they don't speak American fully yet. And it's like, okay, I think you need some time. You need some time in the oven. You know, work on being American and come back to us, because it would be incongruous for us to.
Henry's like, no, Americans need to work on being European. Okay.
Well, there's a synthesis.
It's a shared
America is a European.
European American. We're European American.
But at the same time, you know, so yes, and you know, you have to be of European stock. And we have had people of incongruous alien races attempt to apply. They don't make it very far. You'd be surprised they don't. You know, usually,
surprised. I'm surprised there's some to try.
People are. There's a lot of weirdos.
Yeah.
Out there. And you know, obviously you can't tell everything. I mean, there's just so many strange people in the world. You can't account for anything. Now, it's not common, I mind you. They generally get the idea that, no, this isn't for you. But, you know, there's...
That's what makes them try, though, isn't it?
Well, they still want to
be let in everywhere.
They want to get in everywhere that people don't want them.
Yep.
But there's just so many crazy weirdos in the world that you can't really account for any. For every rule, there's one of those weirdos which will make it an exception. But, yeah, those people do not make it far. Sometimes, very rarely, they're even good natures, and they're like, oh, no, I actually love what you do, and I just wish I could. It's like, that's great. Do it for your own people.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That's great. Do it in your own way, but you know, this is for us. And if we allowed people who were not of our race and nation to be in our organization, then we would be compromising on the principle of representative quality, right? Again, act as a good government should. We want to be of the people we are representing, right? If you have a government made up of one people, you know, say Jews and Indians, for example, trying to represent a populace made of other people, for example, Americans, then that's not going to work, right? So we need the ranks of our membership to be of the same culture that we are trying to represent, being the broader nation. And in particular, you know, we not only want to be American, but we want to be more American. We want to be exemplars. We want to be paragons of the American virtues that we are attempting to bring to the fore. So, you know, that's why the ADL and the SPLC, they call our patriotism garish, because, of course, to somebody like you, yes, it would be. But to us, it just makes sense.
Now, I'll see if I want to squeeze in a question there, Lana. I wanted to, I guess the foundational myth, right, of America is very important, you know, not only to play on it, but to use the accurate history of it as well, because it's been swapped out, right? It's been injected this new vision of what America is, and you can, you know, a couple of easy examples to take is Israel Zangwill's The Idea of the Melting Pot, I think it was a play initially, and then it was a book or something, and then you have, obviously, Emma Lazarus' plaque on the Statue of Liberty, the new Colossus, everyone's welcome, everything.
Well, that's it, this plaque said it, so.
Yeah, but you know, and of course, that doesn't make it right nor true, but it's a fact that that's like, you hear that regurgitated by so many people. Yeah. Well, it was, you know, everyone kind of thing. How do you view that? And like, is that something that needs to just be reversed, destroyed, removed? How do you see that?
I think the plaque should be melted down and turned into something useful. You know, just literally anything else. Maybe we'll make a spoon out of it.
Send it to Israel.
Yes, we'll send it to Israel in the shape of something. Yes, so those things need to be destroyed. Not just the physical objects, but the actual ideas behind them. You know, they are defacements, and the idea, especially of the, you know, the huddled masses poem, you know, that is just a plaque. That was never a piece of legislation. The idea that this is one of the sacred documents of American history, absolutely not. You know, that is not in the same stratosphere as the Declaration of Independence, which is dedicated to ourselves and our posterity. The Declaration of Independence, which was written by Thomas Jefferson, who proclaimed loudly and firmly that you know, that he advances it, therefore, that blacks are inferior to whites in the endowments of mind and body. That's not me. That's what Jefferson said. You know, that's not my quote. But you know, that. But that's who wrote the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence talks about you know, the merciless Indian savages, right? You know, in the same, you know, constitutional convention that they later had, you know, there was this huge debate about the Three-Fifths Compromise. And no side of that debate was saying, oh, well, we should count the slaves as one whole person for the purpose of dividing representative districts. That's not why they were saying it. They were saying it because they wanted additional representatives in Congress. But no side of that was making any of these crazy liberal arguments that you're saying. These things, and Zangwill, I think he had never actually been to America. He was in Russia.
England, I think, right?
England. I believe he was Russian.
Okay, yeah.
Well, but he wasn't actually – he wasn't English or he wasn't Russian.
No, exactly. That's right.
Something
correct.
Else. Yeah. But yes, you know, these elements are so thoroughly foreign to us. And when you – the further you dig into American history, the more you realize that this is an alien component. This is an outside element which has been injected into us, into our society in order to manipulate America by manipulating the identity of its stock. And, you know, America is unique among the European nations. It's even unique among the European diaspora because – in Europe, you know, you have these ethnicities, and you know, the European nations are much older. Now, their modern, you know, iterations are, you know, sometimes younger. The modern state of Germany and Italy are younger than the United States, but their you know, their ethnic, you know,
their ethnic tribes
are much older in many cases. And even the other countries of the diaspora, you know, like Canada and Australia, or the Boers, for example, are much more singular in what ethnicity they came from. However, America is unique that it is the world's only truly pan-European nation, where you had the best stock of Europe, picked from England, Scotland, Ireland, Denmark, Germany, France, and you took them, and I'm probably missing a few. And you know, you took this best stock and you put them on a virgin continent and peopled the whole thing with it. And whereas these European nations have never been fully united in Europe, they were united in America. And this is an immensely powerful heritage. This is something which is so great to be a part of. But it is also something which is extremely thoroughly European. Our conquest was that of the European race. Our conquest was, you know, was something that was written in the ancient sort of traditions of the Anglo-Saxon people to expand and to create something for their families, for their communities, for, you know, I think Thomas Jefferson wrote it in the Summary of British Rights of America, you know, for themselves they conquered. You know, we did not, our ancestors did not stride across the continent for benefit of the British crown. They did it for their families. They did it for their prosperity. And that is the nucleus of the American identity. It is the frontier. And the frontier was a space of warfare. It was a space of immensely, you know, gritty and sometimes even savage men, you know, of our own nation, who were so much stronger and more resolute than a lot of the men you see today. That is the nucleus of the American identity. That's where it's always been. And we had an issue as a nation. We had a decline in the potency of our culture when the frontier was closed. And it wasn't far long after that where you started to have a susceptibility to these foreign elements being injected into our country. But at the same time, we need to seek out the frontier. The frontier is no longer a physical space. It is a space within us. We need to seek out hardship and adventure, and it'll be even better because hardship and adventure will be there for only the men with the will to find it, the men most deserving. You know, hardship makes men, and most of the men of today, the hardship they are given is corporate servitude or financial, you know, drudgery, right? It is being ground down.
Just been ripped away.
But it is horrible, not the hardship which emboldens your character.
No, it's not. And even the idea you mentioned about the fact that there's like practically no unexplored territory left now. I mean, that's a huge issue in and of itself, right? That was an advantage that they had, right? You could cleanse your thirst for adventure by just like, you know, going to those places essentially. And now everything is mapped and GPS and Wi-Fi. So where do you go, right? You know,
everyone knows where all the white people live, right? That's a problem.
they know where to find us.
Dang it.
Well, where do you go is a very cynical benefit of the fact that so much of our traditions and history has been forgotten is that we get to rediscover it. Is that we get to find these places again. Mm-hmm. That so much has been lost, but it's all still there to be found. It's in our blood. It's in our country. It's in our traditions. And by the mere act of unearthing it, by the act of fighting for our sovereignty, we will prove ourselves capable of exercising it.
So you are not a fan of secessionist type of movements. Right.
I think ultimately, you know, I don't mean to be rude, but I think it's silly in the modern context. I think there are some serious questions as to the validity, both on the at the tactical level. I don't really think there's straightforward steps to make. Now, I think intrastate secession does have some legs in certain parts of the country. There's been interesting projects with that about trying to get one state added to another state, but I don't think that's what
Greater Idaho.
Yes, but I don't think that's what people, you know, what you mean when you say secession. Mm-hmm. You know, I think tactically there's not a great outlet for state secession, especially it's not legal in the modern context, and I think even looking at it traditionally, I am questionable as to if it's constitutional. I'm pretty sure once a state has been added to the Union, largely that is a kind of a no take backsies kind of situation, or at least it has been. The Confederacy had a fighting chance with that. They really did, and I love the history of the South. I'm a Southerner myself. I'm proud that Texas fought for the Confederacy, but at the same time, you know, I think national union, you know, was ultimately what had to happen. And as a nationalist, I think one of the principles of what a nationalist is that I believe the limits of government should extend no lesser and no greater than the boundaries of the nation. So I think the whole American nation needs to be united under a single government, a government that can have state sovereignty, a government that can have division of powers. But ultimately, we deserve one government that represents us. Right, and that government shouldn't include other people, and it shouldn't, and it should include all of our people. So secession has issues both in tactical outlook; it has issues in the, you know, classical constitutionality of it, and it has issues in the ideological principles of nationalism. I haven't really seen anything that seriously contests these ideas. I know there have been other. You know, and if for nothing else, you know, especially in the region, there have been movements and individuals which have promoted these ideas, but I think those practices have proven themselves in the practices that upon which they have been implemented or attempted in the region to be quite ineffective and even destructive to the
You don't think like, okay, the more multiracial America becomes, the more things are just going to deteriorate, the government's going to weaken, then there's opportunities for people to maybe break away, do something.
If you're dealing with, you know, and if we're getting into hypotheticals, then everything's hypothetical, right?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah.
But if you're speaking of a circumstance in which so much has changed, that the United States is practically dissolved already, where the power and the legislative authority, and there's no unified society anymore, then things could break up. Things could change. Borders could change at that point. Exactly how, it would be pure theory to guess. Would you call that secession? It could be secession. You could call it Balkanization. But that is possible only through a great list of hypothetical scenarios, which I don't see as immediate or guaranteed. I think very
much just like mass deportations. You don't think we're going to be getting that either.
Eventually it will happen. It has to.
I
think if you're dealing with, if you're talking about the Trump administration, I think it's very complex. You're speaking about machinations within an incredibly complex governmental institution or a number of institutions, and so much corruption has been calcified around the levers of power that even if people in the Trump administration, and I'm sure there are some. Even plenty of them, actually want to deport all the illegals. I'm sure some of them really do. I'm sure a lot of them are just there, thinking that, oh, well, I want to get elected in 4, 8, 12 years, so we better keep all the illegals here so I can get elected on them being a problem. But I'm sure it runs the whole spectrum. However, I think with mass deportations, it's entirely possible that some good things happen. I want to be hopeful that good things can happen. Mm-hmm. I hope that there's people out there other than Patriot Front who want good things to happen for America and are actually capable of solving it. But my stance always with Trump. I mean, even going all the way back to 2017, it's been, I don't support him. I'm not a conservative, and a lot of Trump supporters don't like me, and you know what? That's just fine with them. However, I'm not going to make it my number one MO to hate Trump or try to sabotage the administration, because I think what's important is representing who and what a nationalist is in our context. And I think, the Trumpian administration and a lot of the false conservatism and even the genuine conservatism, which is still not nationalism, I think that is a great foil to nationalism. And its success can sometimes help the nationalist movement if we are properly positioned to take advantages of changes for the better, or we are there to make sure that conservatives who have been exploited, conservatives who have been lied to, they are introduced to new ideas that help them to rectify their misunderstandings of the world. Because for what we are nationalists, again, we are not conservatives. However, a lot of our membership were conservative at some point in their development.
Right.
I think that applies to a lot of the listeners to the show maybe as well.
Yeah.
Probably there are more former conservatives among the audience than there might be former Marxists.
Right.
We might hope.
Yeah.
So, it is a practice of how can we meet them along the way? Right.
Right.
How can we find them, and how can we make sure? Because back in the day, in 2017, you used to talk about the libertarian to alt-right pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
That was a huge deal.
Yep.
But it wasn't actually a pipeline, because pipelines are organized. Pipelines have way stations. Pipelines have engineers.
It was like accidental almost.
Yes. So that was more like a river. It was a watershed. It was very disorganized. But what if we had those and they were actually functioning like pipelines?
Mm-hmm.
What if nationalism had proper outreach strategies around the political landscape in order to facilitate the people recruiting? Because other ideologies have, right?
Yeah.
The left does a great job of picking people up and radicalizing them and moving
That's
them
true.
Wherever they want
yeah.
to be.
Yeah, it's so important, because I meet so many conservatives, even around here. They're so close. They're so close to getting it. They just need a few other thoughts interjected to just make it click in their head,
Surgical operations to try to target and deconstruct. If your interest is to try to convert these people.
Yeah, in conservative
be
areas,
if it is,
I
but,
think.
You know,
yeah.
Because ultimately, right, you want to also win people over, right? You want more more people. You want numbers. And it gets me to the question of the size of America. If you see, what is the white? Does anyone have an actual number? Well, what's the European
How
stock
many white people?
In America? 200-something million? Well, could it be that?
Is it less than that?
Anyway,
it's 300 million.
Okay, regardless,
people.
Around there.
That's a lot of. That's a lot of people, right? And
a lot of potential.
A lot of potential because of that too, but also a lot of then disagreements or other groups that have whole power, jockeying for power and all that.
But
and
you don't need every single one of them.
No, you don't. And that's not my argument either. But just this idea of how try to bring that together. And sure, Russia is a big country. What is that? 120 million there. China is a big country.
Yes.
But these are new. Like you're seeing these new formations in order to just kind of compete on the global stage, right? Mm. which is understandable.
Yes.
But then at the same time, the larger you grow, you lose the margins, you lose the seams, and things are very easily able to fall apart, right?
Yes.
In one sense, it's so hard to have so unifying ideas for
yes.
millions, you know, hundreds of millions of people, right?
Yes.
How do you view that?
So I think, you know, the idea, and this is actually a very interesting question, because the idea of is the country too big? Is America too big? Is this scale of a country able to be governed in the way that it should be? And of course, talking about classical, you know, ideal American government. This is something that the founders debated. This is something that was debated around the time where the Constitution was being drafted and ratified. You know, and it was the idea of, well, a republic, you know, has only existed on something the size of, you know, a few Greek islands, right?
Right.
Or has only existed on the size of the Italian peninsula. How can we possibly expand it over a whole continent? And, you know, the answer of, you know, founding fathers like John Dickinson and John Jay was, well, we will be homogeneous. We'll be as homogeneous as Athens, but as large as Europe. And that did happen. That was the case for a long time. And we had a special form of government which had, you know, it had branches, it had corrections, it had, you know, a very powerful constitution, more powerful than most of those in Europe, that would prevent, you know, quick and radical changes which could, you know, be taken advantage of by a tyrant or something. And it's very easy to look at our history as a nation and think of, oh, well, you know, I wish I was in that room when they were signing this. I wish I was there. I wish I could, you know, grab, you know, Lyndon Johnson by his big floppy ears and swing him out of the window of the Oval Office. I'm sure we all feel that from time to time.
Yes.
But yeah, at the same time, you know, it's important to realize that things could have been a lot worse. And there, you know, our ancestors were smart. Our ancestors were very capable men, you know, by and large, especially the heroes of them. You know, they faced great challenges and they did not have the benefit of living in the future, right? So, you know, in a lot of ways, things could have been much worse if not for the gallantry of our ancestors and fighting for the preservation. But, you know, again, the question of is America too great? No. No, it is not. I mean, now, does the government govern over too many incongruous peoples? Absolutely. But the principle of the nation, we are capable of being unified as an American people across the continent. We are capable of having – we have a core principled model of Republican government which is capable of facing the challenges of governing over such a large space. And this was decided, you know, hundreds of years ago. But – It is incapable in the current status because too many people can vote, because NGOs have too much power, because the branches of government are filled with cowards and criminals. But there is a bone marrow to it. There is a strength in the core principles, and it is possible. And moreover, as a nationalist, I both have the principle that all Americans must be unified in common cause, but I also have the practical experience that I can bring men together from New Hampshire and Virginia and Florida and Mississippi, Kansas, Montana, North Dakota, California, Arizona, and I can get them all in the same field together, and their boots fall in step. It works. It's possible.
Do you ever see the geography just because of the distances alone? As that's hard to keep it in
logistically, it is a challenge, but I'm happy for it. And it's not as much of a challenge as one might think. Just like anything, a logistical, tactical challenge can be overcome with the proper amount of vigilance, diligence, and elbow grease. And I think it's great. I mean, I crisscross the continent, as you all know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, when you're a member of Patriot Front, the country gets a lot smaller. Right. Everything becomes a lot more in focus and it becomes a lot more attainable to get where you need to go. And a lot of people join the organization having not been to a lot of the states regularly, you know, in the travel parties when we're road tripping out to someplace, and it's fun. You know, I'll say, hey, raise your hand if you've ever been to Missouri, if you've ever been to D.C., if you've ever been to, you know, New York City. I remember when we were doing our New York demo, maybe one or two of the guys.
So overrated,
been
man.
There.
New York. Ugh.
Well, it's great for activism. I'll give
it
that.
Yeah, it's good for that.
But, you know, and very often they haven't. So the organization facilitates a lot of these things. You know, the country isn't too large in principle. I think it is overblown in scope and practice. But, you know, just like the end of the manifesto says, you know, at the very – the previous era has been spent broadening and diluting what it means to be an American. But what we are doing is we are refining it. We are purifying it. We are creating something which is more distilled, more functional,
mm-hmm.
more vivacious.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about if you're following anything in terms of what's – there's been an interesting kind of spat, right, recently between Europe, or maybe EU is a better term, because of course those are two different things.
Yes.
But, you know, the current White House, and it seems to be more of a kind of a dislodging in policy towards Europe. And of course, there's been numerous of examples why. You had, the Ukraine war, the funding for that, the Zelensky debacle in the White House, tariff trade war, even the Greenland purchase slash annexation kind of thing as well. I'm not sure if you keep keeping up with any of that, but it
seems,
because again, there's a shared common heritage there, and ideally, these are Europeans that could cooperate, right? But then at the same time, you do have an institution in America.
Yes.
With all this, let's take one example, the Doge stuff, right? They start exposing USAID, how they're funding, tranny theaters in, Kosovo or something. Weird things like this.
Cutting that was the right thing to do.
Obviously, obviously, right? And even the NATO thing, the spending on that, and TIFFs back and forth and whatnot. I think momentarily, at least, it might be a good thing for them to dislodge more of that, and hopefully they can strengthen on their own
and
some type of cooperation more. But currently, I think them separating, so to speak, would be a better. What's your view on that?
Yeah, so it's a very complicated geopolitical thing. I currently do not have any legislative authority to deal with the U.S. foreign policy.
Well, you should.
Yeah, I'm working on it. They make it difficult, They don't just let you walk in. Yes, I do think that as the nations of the European race, we share a common kindred spirit, but at the same time, we aren't completely analogous to each other. And there, goodness knows there have been times in history where European nations do not agree, even to the point of fighting one another. It's actually most of European history, but that's okay. That's how nations work. We do have something common amongst each other that we do not share with other nations. And I do think America should be a friend to Europe. I think America should, especially, the nations from which Americans draw ancestry, we should treat them with a degree of reverence as our former homelands, whereas now we have a new one. But at the same time, when you're dealing with very complex questions of, military strategy and trade, and trade relations, and all of these other matters, it is incredibly dynamic. I do think a lot of people, there's so many people pulling at these institutions because they have because they're all invested, right? There's so many people.
So much money too. Flowing
so many lobbyists, and if so many people, and especially with the war going on, and I think the war is a tragedy. It is horrific to think about all of the European men and women and children who have been killed, murdered, displaced, who are starving, who are suffering from disease in these countries. It is just how much good all of those, I think, have a million people died yet? Is it up?
At least, I think, if you count both sides.
As an organizer of men. And, as somebody who I know the men I organize, and I'm always fighting for more, and I know how scarce and valuable a resource, our European men of fighting stock are. To see that destruction of that is absolutely horrific. And I think I understand it in a way that I think a lot of people don't. As a leader myself, but I hope that comes to an end as soon as possible. But how does the U.S. do that? I think trying to be a peace broker instead of an arms dealer is a good step.
Yes.
But the fact that getting Russia and Ukraine to stop fighting each other, the fact that that's not easy is not surprising.
No.
And moreover, there's so many European nations which not only have a very genuine oppositional, they have a very genuine distaste for Russia. But they also – there are so many people who would benefit from a war. There's so many people – and not the people, of course.
No.
Not the populace, but the people who own the factories, the people who are selling the missiles, the people who are making the drones, the people – the politicians who would love to revoke the freedoms and liberties that those nations still maintain under wartime conditions. If it were up to me, of course, America would be a friend to Europe, but we wouldn't be attached into every rivalry. I kind of follow the traditional principle of the Monroe Doctrine, of George Washington's farewell address, and of Charles Lindbergh, the famed aviator and the initiator of America First, right? He loved his European heritage. He loved Europe. He traveled across Europe, but at the same time, he didn't think America should be fighting all of their wars. Mm-hmm. And I think had America maybe been less involved in certain European conflicts in the past, both them and us would be in a better situation. And I think that today, you know, when you go back and you read Lindbergh's speeches, you know, Patriot Front, we have copies of Lindbergh's speeches that we send out to all the members, and we send them out around the country, through our activism. You know, reading that and thinking about the current conflicts in Europe, you know, when he was, you know, very oppositional to World War II, there's so many similarities, and there's even similarities to what's going on in Israel and Gaza. Again, our ancestors were smart men, right? They were just lived in different times. America, a friend to Europe, but perhaps not an entangled ally.
Because I think it was from the Monroe Doctrine. It was, what was the passage? Key points was the U.S. would not interfere in political affairs of Europe, right? And that's why I'm talking about that dislodging, right?
Yes.
That it would be better for Americans to have less of that, you know, meddling going
perhaps.
On. Perhaps. I mean, because at the same time, we're all kind of inflicted by the same problem. Most European nations' leaders are corrupted. They are self-serving. Mm-hmm. They serve foreign interests in some regards.
Yes.
And the same, you know, we share much of the same infliction. And so, you know, America's official foreign policy towards Europe is not really that of what American people would actually want it to be. Right?
No, and perhaps if America becomes a little bit more isolationist, which it seems to be trying in every
it's
country
kind of,
but Israel, it's funny.
Yeah, exactly.
But it could allow Europe to assert itself in an industrial capacity and also to achieve more of its own sphere of influence, which could be helpful in the long run for nationalist movements in Europe, because the politicians would have to start making overtures about, hey, we need to assert ourselves as our own country and not, hey, we need to lobby for another country to help pay all of our bills.
Exactly.
So that could be a good thing. It could accelerate certain conflicts. The theorizing about hypotheticals of global geopolitical strategy are a little bit outside of my usual pay grade, unfortunately. But the principles I follow are those that America should be a friend to the world, but an ally to none, and a great friend to Europe.
Yeah, indeed.
A few more questions here.
Let's hit it.
So obviously voting isn't working. So what should we be focusing on? Kind of building a parallel society, folk first society. What?
Definitely folk first. Folk first.
Not less.
Some smart people have been using that slogan lately. I really like it. We can't vote our way out of our problems, but we can organize our way out of them. That is something which, you know, Americans are really good at. Europeans are especially very good at. We can take people, we can take resources, we can work them to solve problems, and that's what organizing is. Electorally, a purely electoral political strategy will not achieve the results we want. You might theoretically, in some circumstances, be able to achieve some results of a positive nature with it, maybe in the local level, maybe random offices that aren't that well defended. That's possible. That's not going to be a comprehensive winning strategy for you. So what you need to do is you need to employ, you know, again, I'm biased. I think Patriot Front's doing it. We need to employ a wide array of tactics, which all have a uniting strategy. And that needs to be everything that the organization does. We do charity work. We improve people physically. We improve people educationally. We create mass media, you know, marketing promotion. We do everything we can do. We do everything we can do to change people's lives at every level that we can find them and every level that we can achieve entry into these institutions in physical spaces or social spaces or pieces of infrastructure that we can attain and then utilize for change. And conventional politics and electoral strategy doesn't need to be forever divorced from that. I think there are ways to engage in that. And if I was to run for president, which I can't do until I'm 35 anyways, but if I was to run, you know, my first objective would be to try to win. Of course, that's a given. But the second very close objective, seeing as I might not win, who knows, a lot could change, but seeing as I might not win, my second close objective would be using that as a means to reach people. Because a lot of people out there who are not acquainted with nationalist or revolutionary ideas, they, when you're trying to explain, you know, revolutionary activism and organizing and building communities, it's a little bit hard sometimes to get the point across because it is abnormal. It should be the normal, but it is unusual to somebody who is totally unacquainted with these things. But if you tell somebody, oh, I'm running for office, they get that, right? That just clicks, right? Now, of course, they don't know that one of those is effective and the other one isn't. But you can use one of them to introduce them to the broader span of the other, right? And electoral politics are where a lot of people are, and you need to get them to where they need to be. So sometimes stepping into the room of where your people are in order to escort them to where they need to be could be a valuable tactic. But again, you know, if I was running for president, you know, besides trying to win, what I would really be trying to do is reach people and create and allow them to help work with my extra political strategies.
Yeah. So again, people have it wrong, right? They think this is going to be a top-down solution. What you guys are doing is the right approach, not only building men up, but doing it from the bottom up, right? And I think that's the only way. I mean, as you mentioned before, the corruption of the system. And again, even if you get a White House administration next, the permanent government is always there.
Enough.
The NGOs are there. The whole infrastructure around, rotten to the core. You know,
our
people
are not ready for a nationalist president because we haven't done enough work to deserve one yet. You know, there's so much wrong that it needs to be confronted at the very deep levels. You know, the demographic America needs most, we cannot recruit, but we must create.
Right.
There are men out there who will be the statesmen of tomorrow, but right now they are young. Right now they need the experience. They need the lives. You know, some of the most famous, you know, Americans like, you know, Theodore Roosevelt and Andrew Jackson and even George Washington, you know, they had lives of struggle and contest where they were, you know, they were frontiersmen. They grew up in log cabins. They had to climb the ranks, you know, through the military and through, you know, Andrew Jackson was a lawyer and then a judge and then he was a general and then he was president. You know, we need to build up our next generation of statesmen through the hardship and through the trials of our politics, because only within our politics can men find the proper strife, the proper struggles, the proper opposition that will shape them into the men that America will need. Now, exactly what roles they might be filling, you know, will that be the role of generals or judges or statesmen or what have you, or community leaders? I'm not sure, but right now what we need to do is be building them and to be creating spaces that will become incubators for the leaders of tomorrow.
Yeah, I think you touched on this earlier, but you talk about the Boy Scout experience and stuff like that too. But just like vital things of how when boys turn into men, how those are missing, right?
Yes.
There's no initiation type of things that you're reborn into a life as a man largely anymore. It's not, you know, and so that you have arrested development and all that stuff. You have to build this. Now, the plus side, of course, with the times that we're in generally, most Western countries, I'd say, is that we are, whether we want to or not, being served up with some of those hardships right now. And it might, you know, because I think complacency is an enemy, right? Mm. Comfort is an enemy. And it will just make us weaker and softer and more dependent on external, you know, governance and authority to step in and say, we got this for you. Just relax. Don't do anything. Don't try harder. You know, you're just you're great just as you are. So the challenges are key. And luckily, I think we live in a time where that's on the rise again, right? We're kind of forced to step up. Either we make this, right? We succeed or we break, essentially.
Someday they may regret giving us such dire cause to innovate.
Right.
And I certainly hope that they do.
Yeah, that's true. It's interesting.
Religion.
That's one thing I wanted to ask you. Yeah, go ahead.
We're never supposed to talk about religion and politics, but of course, you know, what else is there to
talk about? I talk about it frequently. No questions are off limits. Let's hear it.
So religion within the organization.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
So the organization itself is secular, right? The organization does not have an official religion, you know, that we try to enforce upon a membership, because I do try to follow the traditional American principle of religious liberty, but I follow it in the context in which the founders meant it, which is those of European stock and high moral character. Mm-hmm. So necessarily we only allow those of faiths, which pretty much exclusively falls into Christianity and paganism, and that's, you know, European paganism, often Germanic in nature, and, you know, the sects of Christianity, which usually in the organization is split up between those who are Protestant and Catholic, you know, and in that you have the Lutherans, and we have some Mormons too. But, you know, that is allowed because those faiths are European in character, mm-hmm. And also in line with our moral practices. Not everybody who follows those religions is in line with our moral principles as the organization, but the ones who are let in are, right? And, you know, though the organization is secular, its membership is religious, and they largely fall into those categories. And we have members who are not religious at all or in general, which is fine as well. You know, so we allow that, but we also facilitate religious expression where we can. Recently, we published a video, which was a group prayer, which was held after our March for Life, rally outside in D.C., And in other cases, you know, when we are being being hosted on somebody's land, and they, you know, they follow, you know, European paganism, we have had ceremonies there. And in all these cases where these ceremonies are taking place, whether it's a group prayer or it's a bloat, not everybody has to participate.
That's right. Yeah.
But everybody has to. But if you are not going to participate, we ask that you are at least respectful.
Yeah.
And they are. And we really do not suffer from any infighting or conflict of this. You know, you hear online, and I see it from time to time, people talking about division between these groups and even between Christian denominations, which of course is,
oh my gosh,
you know,
yes.
It's they've only been fighting for a few thousand years. It's not a new thing.
You're not going to solve that. Yes.
But you know, when I see these things, I look around in the organization. It's like I think we're good. You know, we have a really solid principle structure that we are able to navigate and include people of these different faiths without it being a large issue, because we have so much that unites us.
That's not the foundation of the group.
The organization is not a religious group.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I am able to effectively represent all of them. Right, you know, just again, like a good government should. I look at all these people and I hear all of their needs and interests equally, right? And I am able to represent all of them and their interests, and I facilitate the expression. And you know, everybody works together. And the benefit is we have the American tradition and history to back up what we're doing, which you know, helps since we happen to be patriots.
Yeah.
You know, so. I mean, it's great, and I think it's really interesting because I love learning about, you know, what these men believe and their you know, their theology and the way they have come to these experiences. And I think broadly, you know, a lot of young guys are getting more religious because, you know, whether they're getting into paganism or Catholicism or Orthodoxy or, you know, Christianity in general or anything, it's because I think there's a huge desire to find the old ways, mm-hmm. to find the traditions, to look back and say, well, I'm so alienated, you know, I have nothing in my community that is giving me purpose or broader meaning, so I'm going to look sometimes as far back as I can, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to look thousands of years ago and see how people worked it out there. And that is a very interesting phenomenon. I think it does bode well for nationalism, looking back at the principles and the, you know, the ancient virtues of civilization.
Yes.
Yeah, you got the legitimacy of history in a way, right? You have that to stand on, and men have done it before you and all that stuff. But one of the things I want to ask you about as well is, you kind of addressed some of this already, obviously, but just the long-term, you know, goal for Patriot Front, and what would you like to see the organization evolving into? And obviously, an interesting extension to that, again, hypotheticals, but it's interesting to hear your thoughts on it.
Yes.
If let's say resources and manpower wasn't an issue, well, you know, where would you like to see it go?
Well, I'd like to have a 51st state on the moon. Resources were not an issue. So, you know, largely speaking, everything that the organization does, you know, benefits from being scalable, right? We have a lot of networks. You know, we have 22 networks right now all across the country, and that encompasses almost the entire continent, except for a few stubborn spots, but we're working on it, and they won't last long. But the benefit is whenever one network accomplishes something or achieves a new method, tactic, or, you know, employs a strategy to success, then we are able to replicate that across the country. You know, so what would the answer is kind of, what would one network do? Well, what would 20 of them do?
Right. Yeah.
What would 10 men do? Well, what would 100 of them do? And we've already scaled up a lot of things, because a lot of the change that we are trying to implement, you know, can be summarized as a lot of small changes yielding to big ones. And those changes can be in the lives of individual men, or they can be in, you know, the accomplishments of certain forms of activism or charity. You know, if, you know, 5-10 years down the line, I hope to, you know, 5 times, 10 times everything we're doing, which would in turn create it would have 5 to 10 times as many people and 5 to 10 times as much change, yielding to 5 to 10 times as many broader supporters, you know, knowing and changing things. And then the country is moving that much more in our direction. You know, it's I think I said in the video that we want to make the country more like we like it and less like we don't, you know, which is, you know, it's the bare bones simplicity of it. But, you know, if resources and manpower weren't an issue, well, you know, the organization would have already won, because we're in touch with infinity at that point. But you know, the ultimate culmination, and I think it is sometimes reductive to try to, you know, imagine the final victory scenario, because that is in itself a little strange sometimes, because the nation is timeless. The nation lives as a person does through a family. The nation is immortal. The nation's cause does not end. So. You know, the nation will always live on, and there will be at no point where patriots are not required to sustain and fight for their country until that country dies, and we certainly will not let that happen so long as we're around. But, you know, a culmination of a realization of the nationalist ideal, I think, would be sovereignty, right? We have the nation-state principle that, you know, one nation, one state. The government extends to the bounds of the nation, no lesser, no further. We want all Americans united under a government, and we want that government to be tasked only with representing those Americans. We want both a return to the classical principles of the American Republic with an added revolutionary forward-thinking element of all that we've learned in the past 100 years, all that we've learned since America has been perverted into a democracy.
All the mistakes, right?
Yes. So, we're not nostalgic. We're not looking to go back to the 60s or even the 1700s and just think, oh, let's try to make everything like it was back then. No, we are forward-looking. We are revolutionary. But there are principles of history which should not be left behind, just as there are plenty of things that need to be cast aside because they are no longer useful to the American nation anymore.
But it's a living, living, right? Therefore, it evolves and transforms.
It must. It has to. And the adaptability of Americans has been our strength for so long, especially when you look to the colonists and the frontiersmen. The fact that we have faced so many challenges that, our European cousins have not had the opportunity to, I think it gives us something that will.
Well, there's some Canadians who are like, I need to reclaim Canada, I see in the chat.
Yes. Yeah.
Or reclaim Australia, reclaim all the colonies for Europeans, basically.
Absolutely. And I want them to reclaim their countries, and I do sincerely hope, and there are good nationalists in all of those countries, and we've had the benefit of seeing and working with them from time to time, not only in Europe, but in the diaspora as well. We've had activists go to Canada, go to South Africa as well, and meet with the Boers. And I want them to reclaim their countries. I want them, and if they are in a position to be, I hope that they are inspired by what we do. I hope that they can gain whatever there is to gain by viewing and supporting our cause here in America. And I do think the United States is at the pinnacle of global, hegemony that is causing a lot of the ails in the world, that is exporting. You spoke about the USAID thing, right?
Yeah.
Then the U.S. has been exporting this terrible, liberal multiracial democracy. So if things change here, it will be a great help to those in all of the other, cousin
nations.
Yeah,
I think free that up.
Yes.
The pressure, the boot that's been on for a while.
So no pressure to us, but it's a lot on our shoulders, right? We need to save them as well, but we need to save ourselves in order to do it.
Well, that's just it. If everyone takes their responsibility in their respective European or European diaspora countries, we're in a much better position. But no, definitely. I mean, eventually, there needs to be, nationalism is great, but also this idea that there needs to be a pan-national identity of sorts, right? Where you realize that we are in this together, much more powerful. Because I mean, again, we don't have to get into a whole spiel here about be that India or China or something like that. But there's new conglomerates and the BRICS countries and stuff,
yes.
And they're building, and there's some, not always, obviously,
I think the trend has been for things to be larger and more consolidated
exactly.
In geopolitics.
Yeah.
I think specifics of, specific relations between countries at specific points, those can be varied, but the larger principle, I do think there should be sort of a pan-racial understanding of countries. Now, I don't believe in trying to put all the whole European race under a single government. I think that would be utterly impractical.
EU is trying that, right? Look at that. It is basically like a federalization of Europe.
Except they don't actually care about European people.
They're running into a few problems, to say
it's
the least.
Very hard.
But a larger understanding among our nations and a larger affinity for one another, I think, is obvious. And I think that is founded in traditional American statesmanship. You look back to Andrew Jackson is a great example of a president who was immensely proud of his heritage. He was Irish originally. He was born in America, but his parents were Irish. And Thomas Jefferson was fascinated with the heritage of the British tradition and the Anglo-Saxon culture. And Theodore Roosevelt was very studious and interested in, the conquests of, the settlers in Australia and in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And he compared and contrasted, these with the conquests of America. So having this larger racial understanding is incredibly important, and I think even necessary when you look broadly into the future. But at the same time, you know, we should have a pride in our own nations. I think a lot of young men, and you used to see this more, I think, in previous years, and you know, we're working on it now, is a lot of young men approaching nationalist ideas would feel like they had to be, that they couldn't be patriotic, that they couldn't, you know, have a love for their own country. Because it was kind of a grass is greener sort of idea. So, oh, well, Europe, you know, they have all the real countries. And in America here, where, you know, we don't have a heritage, you know, it's so bad and woe is me. But, you know, and a lot of times, you know, we've spoken to European nationalists, and when they see Americans acting like that, they don't think highly of it. You know, they're like, what are you doing? Right? You know, come on. So, you know, we finding our own identity also allows us to be more respected among the Hall of Nations, and also allows us to be able to practice our own nationalism in a way that is more inspirational and actually more helpful to other countries. Because if we were all just trying to be like each other, nobody would.
No, of course not.
It wouldn't be very effective.
No, definitely not. Now, again, I mean, the links are there's a tie between them. There's a historical root that European Americans have in Europe, you know, whether you want to call that the homeland or not. But the point is, it's now this is a European, you know, not only colony, but a new country formed by Europeans. You know what I mean? And it's collectively ours. You know what I mean? And
I think that fits with this question that someone asks there. If white America is reclaimed, where does that leave non-white citizens?
Somewhere else.
Yeah, anywhere but
so, you know, if
who cares? Maybe that's
So to answer the question, you know, that's the short answer. The long answer is, you know, America being reclaimed it's not just a matter of drawing lines on the map, right? It is a broader matter of political destiny. It's a broader matter of our identity and our philosophy, and the understanding of America. Now, if there, you know, can America be reclaimed while there are still, you know, people who are not American under the jurisdiction of the United States? You know, maybe. I mean, America has had much better positions in the past while it's governed over imperialistic territories. Now, I'm not an imperialistic person, but, you know, you're looking at a very complex answer. But ultimately, to fix the demographics of the country, you know, you could talk about all sorts of solutions. You know, obviously, deportations of every illegal immigrant, that's easy. That's totally, I mean, it's not easy.
A good start.
But it's legal, right? Yeah. It's legal, yeah. And it's totally on the board. You know, and then you have other methods that you could use to remove even more people with incentives and economic matters and, you know, tax remittances and you know, visas. There's 100 different tactics you could employ. That's not the problem. Coming up with the ideas of here's things to do is not the problem. The problem is finding men in the right places, especially in the government, with the willpower to exert them. And they don't. They don't have it. And even if some of them, like I mentioned earlier, some of them are probably genuine and actually want to deport all the illegals, right? But they're drowned out by the corruption. They're drowned out by the weaklings, the spineless, and the cowards. You know, so we need to, from the ground up, create the Americans that will not compromise. We need to create the Americans that can stand against the whole world, if that's what it takes. We need to create the Americans to whom sacrifice is second nature. And that's what we're doing. And you know, what will America look like once it's been reclaimed? Well, it'll be both unrecognizable and also instinctually home. That's what I would say.
Yeah.
Red Pill says, always solid. Thank you very much. And Arctic Wolf says, hey guys, I'm still at work, going to watch on replay later this evening. Really excited for the show. You guys rock. Take care.
Thank you, Albert. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
It's good hearing you. There's a couple more there, Lana, if you refresh.
I'll
take it.
That,
McDozer, yet another outstanding interview. Can't wait to share this episode everywhere I possibly can. Thank you, McDozer. Appreciate it.
Thank you, McDozer.
Unconstructed Yeoman says, hat tip to Thomas from a fellow Texican. I think he says, is that an actual term, Texican?
It is. Well, originally there were Texicans, and then there were Texians, and then there were Texans, you know, but sure.
Texian. No. All right, we'll take it. Yeah.
Yes, we'll take it.
So, yeah, hat tip to Thomas from a fellow Texican. He's done a lot worth admiring, admiration, let me read that right instead, and Patriot Front will have a lasting legacy of tough men and have the ability to organize, even though it will eventually fail because it has some various essential things wrong. Really?
Oh,
okay.
Let's hear it.
What is it? But I look forward to seeing the progress as far. Well, you need to put those in the chat then, Yeomans. We can address them. I appreciate that. Thank you.
He's very bold.
Yes.
Tips his These hat couple and then insults.
Well, you know, but as you said before, then, well, you're welcome to do it right, as you said.
I'm not afraid of any questions. I'd love to hear.
Exactly. Yeah, do it right this time. All right, very good. Lana, did you have any closing question step before we start up and up?
I think that's
fine. It's very good. Anything, Thomas? Anything else like that we haven't addressed that you think is important in this context?
I think it's absolutely a pleasure to be on the show. I remember watching y'all's show on and off for all the way back to 2017.
Oh, nice.
Y'all are really solid, and y'all are an institution in the messaging in this side of the political landscape. And it is, you know, I need to give y'all credit for how resolute y'all have been throughout everything, because that is not, you don't find that every day. Yeah. And, you know, so y'all have certainly done something very much worthy of praise, and that I am thankful for. And I've been up in the area, you know, for a day and a half now, and the hospitality I've been shown by all the people y'all know and the people y'all work with locally has been absolutely magnanimous. Nice. And I can't speak highly enough. You know, you can judge a person by the quality of people they surround themselves
with.
That's true. And if I didn't already have a great opinion of y'all, which I do, it's expanded and heightened even more so. So thanks for that, and I want that to be known. You know, I assume there's a lot of people listening who maybe haven't heard me speak, or maybe haven't been familiar with Patriot Front in particular. But you know, if you're interested, you know, I want you to reach out and apply. You know, you look at the website there. There's the join page. I want you to fill that out. I want you to read the content on the website, and I want you to make the decision for yourself ultimately, not just because I asked you, even though that is a great reason. But you know, the country's waiting for you, right? There's an opportunity. There's a life out there, and no matter where you are in the country, we got somebody near you. No matter what lifestyle you have, right? You're working class, you're white collar, you're blue collar, you're gray collar, you know, you own a business, right? You work for a big company, you know, you're in some sort of profession, you're a college student, you're 18 and you don't know what you're going to do, right? We have men like you. We have a place for you. We have a way for you to serve the nation and also benefit from that service. You know, somebody in the organization, it's good for you. It's good for your life. It's good for your future. You know, and we need people everywhere. We need people of all kinds, you know, specifically American men, right? But and if you think you're not up for it, apply and see and find out. You might be. But yeah, and again, it's been phenomenal. I've really enjoyed the discussion. I think you all have asked a lot of good questions and a lot of subjects we don't really broach on a lot of the interviews. So it's good to find a very unique discussion.
And awesome.
Been a great time.
One more here. Cuckfree Zone says, I love what Thomas said about America being the only real pan-European country. Perhaps this is where Yaki's dream can actually come true. I'm not sure if you have any input
perhaps
on that.
Yeah. Perhaps. Well, I am not extremely familiar with Yaki, but it, you know, creating a pan-European superstate is very difficult in Europe, but it has kind of already happened in America.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
If that was your goal, then you should be proud to be an American.
I think one more here.
Goodness knows I am.
Zionist Cuck, great username, says, Mr. Rousseau said, let me see here. I lost it now. Hang on.
Oh, no.
Hang on. I'll get to it.
We lost the Zionist cuck.
He's gone. Where'd you go?
There we need more of those, don't we? That's what we need right now.
I wish we couldn't find any of them.
Mr. Rousseau said Christianity comes from Europe. Which part exactly, he says?
Yes. So obviously the stories of the Bible take place in the Middle East, but Christianity was brought to Europe immediately by one or several of the apostles, and it was practiced in Europe for thousands of years. And I think European culture...
You've answered this one before, huh?
European culture and Christianity, you know, I am not personally religious, but European culture and Christianity have been heartily intertwined. And also, speaking specifically about American culture, you know, the first people who come, even Leif Erikson, who arrived 1,000 years ago, was Christian. So there is obviously... too Anglophone. But obviously, I'm not fond of the religious infighting.
It's
tiresome.
If he persists in such ways, he's harming his prospects of membership in Patriot Front. So you should be careful.
There you go. Well, Thomas, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Very good.
Great admirer, obviously, of not only you personally, but the whole organization, you've been able to accomplish so far, we should say. So it's been
We're
a pleasure.
That's
That's it. That's it. Just getting started. All those little bricks to the foundation is being laid right now. That's how I view it. If we can see our children, our grandchildren, or so forth, you know, actually have something solid by the time that they're old enough to appreciate it, then we've done good work. Rome isn't built overnight, as I say, you know, so or over a day. Yeah. All right, I'm going to do a couple of plugs here real quick. I do want to ask you where, obviously, patriotfront.us, right?
Yes.
That's the website. You do have some social medias as well where people can follow you guys.
Social page. There we go.
Tell us about that, yeah.
Yes, so, you know, we have the Patriot Front updates. We recently had to change our Telegram page because the old one got banned. Sons of Columbia is a catalog of essentially Americana of all kinds. Patriot Front sightings is where you go to find news about us. We document that. Promotional materials, you can see cities all over the country that we've placed stickers, flyers, and posters and such. And actually, if you want to see if there's PF near you, searching on the Patriot Front promotional materials Telegram is a great way to do that. We're on Gab. We're on Odyssey. We were banned from Rumble, surprisingly. We're still on BitChute. You can find some of our videos on TikTok and YouTube and on Twitter. But, you know, they're always coming up and going down, so you got to find them. If you want to find them, you can find us there if you're lucky. But if you want to find our solid official places for content, you go to the website. And actually, if you scroll just a little bit down on the social page, you can find two of the big interviews we've done with Jake Shields and Patrick Bet-David, which are allowed on YouTube and Spotify and all those other things. And I think those are further enlightening. If you've listened to this and you haven't listened to me before and you think, wow, that's really interesting, I want to hear more about what he has to say, that's a great place to start.
Yeah, right. Jake's cool. We had him here too.
I know.
He spoke highly of you.
Here, or was it that chair?
He's a good guy.
I was that chair.
Okay. Close.
Close enough. Yeah. Exactly.
That was a good one.
All right, well, gentlemen out there listening, if you want to go join, you know where to go, patriotfront.us. As I said, I do want to do a couple of plugs here before we let you guys
go.
But thank you, everyone. Yes,
we're hungry.
Dinner here. But yes. Guys, if you want to support us and what we do, redicemembers.com. Odyssey is currently demonetized, de-striped, as it were, but Subscribestar or Locals, that's two options as well. And before we wrap up, I do want to say thank you to our both producers and executive producers. That's another way you can support us. Thank you to T. Lothrop Stoddard, V. Miller, Resin Revolt, Good Luck Lap, Jake, Red Pill Rundown, we have French 47, Mark Smith, No One Jeebs, President Ubunga, Mongoose, we got William Fox, Angry White Soccer Mom, The Second Wanderer, Operation Werewolf, we also have The Ride Never Ends, Last Place Simp, Joseph Hart, Purple Haze, Rex Ballington, we have Commie Combo Deal, The Dearborn Toxic Event, Brendan Anthony, Penelope 7 USA, Bertrand Compere, I think you pronounce that like that, Dixie Drone Force, Arctic Wolf, shout out to Albert, we also have Europe Awake and Teutonic Werebear, and also thank you to our producers, we have Mr. Walker, 696, Yuanson, Leroy Dumont, Snarkpup, Eyes Open, Mr. Lemry, Yuri New, Obadiah Hexwell, Perfect Brute, Single Action Army, Lord H.P. Lovecraft, Trevor, Der Schwabe, Sonata for Violin, Whitewater Rafting Fan, Jetfire, ExposeFlyers.com, Shane B., Restitutor Orbis, Alcyon, and The Boo Man. All right, that's about wraps it up. You guys, if you want to get one of those, producer or executive producer tier, RedIceMembers.com, that's really the best place. All right, that's it for us then. Thank you
that's
for watching,
right.
Everybody. Thank you, Thomas, once more for coming in.
Yeah.
Pleasure
thank
having you,
so
you
much.
Here. Thank you for being up in these parts and come visiting us. It's been,
I'll be back.
It's been a pleasure. Oh, we hope so. You better be. All right, guys. Thank you so much for watching. Be back tomorrow with Flashback Friday, by the way. Two Swedes joining us, Don Eriksson and Magnus Söderman. So tune in for that for Flashback
Friday.
Oh,
no. Three Lorna. Swedes. Can we handle that?
You're going to take over the whole
thing. And those Swedes are taking over America.
That's right. All right. So, Lana, you won't be joining us, but we'll see if Western Warrior. All right. Bye, everybody. Take
see
care.
Ya.
Bye.
Thank you for watching. Go to redicemembers.com and sign up for exclusive members content. Don't miss our latest shows, interviews, and other videos only for subscribers. You can also become a member by signing up at subscribestar.com/redice. Get full access and help support our work. See you on the other side.